From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1996, Harvard heavyweight Samuel Huntington sounded the alarm for a coming clash of civilizations. After 9/11, people listened. Now, Samuel Huntington is focusing his attention right here at home, not over a clash of civilizations, but a clash of cultures. He's looked to the future and sees an America on the edge of losing its core national identity, specifically the Anglo-Protestant cultural touchstone of the founders. And who's to blame? Elites, globalists, multiculturalists, and the burgeoning wave of Hispanic immigrants arriving in the U.S. every year, especially from Mexico. Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. No, thank you, says Samuel Huntington. Not if they're unwilling to assimilate, and not if they won't embrace America's Anglo-Protestant cultural tradition. Tonight on Point, Samuel Huntington's Two Americas, and maybe more, multiculturalism, culture, and national identity in a changing nation. Has multiculturalism in America gone too far, as Samuel Huntington suggests? Is it time for all Americans to find their inner Anglo-Protestant to save the national identity? Can we be profoundly diverse and profoundly American or not? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Samuel Huntington, professor and chairman of the Harvard Academy for International and Area Studies at Harvard University. His 1996 book, The Clash of Civilizations, was a national bestseller and translated into more than 30 languages. His new book is Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity. Good evening and welcome, Samuel Huntington.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, Tom.
It's wonderful to have you. Also with us in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you right here.
Good to be here.
So, Samuel Huntington, set us straight. Here we've been celebrating diversity and multiculturalism very publicly in many forums in America for years now. You present that as a dire threat to the core identity of the nation. Why?
Well, first of all, let me say I don't think I present it as a threat. I much prefer the word challenge. Threat implies something immediate and really devastating. I think
challenge or threat, but you do describe it as potentially leading to the disintegration of the national culture, the loss of core American identity.
Well, I think it is certainly a challenge to the national culture, as you indicated, and along with all these other factors. Mm-hmm. And multiculturalism is only one factor I treat in my book. The whole purpose of the book is to make the argument that it is time for Americans to take the question of their national identity seriously. I think we have had a core national identity for most of our history, and there are challenges to that now. And that core identity was certainly compatible with a huge range of diversity, with sub-identities and subgroups in our society. Mm-hmm. But there was this core. And if that core is weakened or disappears, we will become a different country. And I don't think we want the Americans 25 years from now to sort of wake up and say, hey, what happened to our the country we used to have? How did it happen that we're so different now? We ought to think about what the challenges are, whether they will are threatening or non-threatening, and how we can try to shape our identity in positive fashion. Not that we should maintain exactly what we have at the moment at all, but I think we ought to think about these issues and have a serious discussion about them, and that is what I hope my book may provoke.
Fair enough. We're going to dig in on many fronts. As you say, there are many elements that you bring to the table here. You're very clear in defining what you call the American creed, with its principles, as you describe them, of liberty, equality, individualism, representative government, and private property. Mm-hmm. I come back again, just because so many people will have thought of multiculturalism as something to celebrate and an American strength, and in fact, a sign of American strength for the future. Why can't the American creed, as you define it here, liberty, equality, individualism, why can't that flourish in a diverse culture that celebrates multiculturalism as a central tenet, as you point out, America has come to do in many quarters?
Well, I think if we move from a society where there is a core culture, which is widely shared by most of the people, and indeed is the culture that has attracted so many millions of immigrants to this country, and instead move into becoming a country with many different cultures, that is likely, I'm not saying it's, well, certainly, but it is likely to undermine this creed you just referred to, which that creed was a product of this Anglo-Protestant historical culture we have had. And if we have many cultures in this country playing equal roles, then we are very likely to develop different sets of political ideas. Now, as I say, that's not absolutely certain, but it seems to me it is very difficult to have a country which is united only by a set of political principles.
But why should that be? I think many Americans have come to believe that these principles, the magnetism of the American creed, of liberty, equality, individualism, the magnetism is so powerful that immigrants from any culture can adopt, embrace, embody this creed. Are you saying that someone from China or Vietnam or Senegal or Mexico is less capable, less likely of understanding, embracing, fighting for the American creed?
No, but that's precisely the problem. The fact is that to the extent that people in other countries share these political principles, and we like to think of them as universal principles, applicable everywhere, and liberty, equality, and so forth and so on, that then doesn't become a defining characteristic of Americans. What makes us different from the Indonesians if all the Indonesians believe in the same principles we do, and that's the only thing we have in common?
Well, if all Indonesians embrace liberty, equality, individualism, representative government, private property, do we still have to search for an us and them? Aren't they then one with Americans in the ways that matter?
Well, no. Not at all.
Because they're not Anglo? Because they're not Protestant?
Well, because they will have a different language, a different culture, a different history, a different traditions and from ours, and they won't be Americans. Just because they believe or say they believe, as lots of people do around the world, in these principles in which we believe, doesn't make them Americans. There's something more involved, and that involves the involvement in our, as I say, our culture and society. Society and traditions, and accepting American historical experience as their historical experience, and a whole wide variety of other things. And there are other aspects of this beyond these political principles, which are of crucial importance, as I point out in my book, central to our culture, our Anglo-Protestant culture, and derived from the Protestantism of the Reformation is the sense of individualism we have in this country. We are the most individualistic country in the world by every comparative survey.
And yet we've seen people from all over the world respond to that and explode with individualism in this country. I wish you'd...
Well, no, wait a second.
Yes?
Indonesians don't have the same proclivity to individualism we do.
But the American context, we've seen immigrant after immigrant.
Oh, that's a different question. That's a different question.
But they're Americans.
What? Sure. But if 200 million Indonesians came here and learned English and our traditions and our culture and so forth and so on, became Americans, they would undoubtedly share our individualism. But that's not going to happen. And hence, we are different, very markedly different, as I say, in terms of our individualism from most other countries in the world. In fact, from all other countries, we are way over one end of that particular dimension. We have a work ethic, which is not shared by other countries in the world.
I've seen some pretty hardworking countries out there. Visit Asia. Check it out.
Sure. But in terms of the extent to which people work, we work more than anybody else in the world. Hours per day, days per month, weeks per year. But most importantly, it isn't just that we work more, because that's not that significant. It's the way in which we view our work. We think work is good. And there are, again, survey after survey that show that we are work-oriented. And this is something which isn't a product of recent years. Tocqueville commented on this, and many other European observers in the 19th and early 20th centuries commented on it. One of the fascinating things, which I refer to briefly in my book, are the letters which immigrants from Europe sent home after coming here in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. A standard theme in this is how hard they have to work here. It was so easy back in Poland. Now they say we have to work so hard here.
America asked a lot and gave a lot in return. And somewhere in there, Jack Beattie, in that underlying culture, Anglo-Protestant, Samuel Huntington finds the necessary precursor of the American creed. Lose that link to the root culture, and the ideology ultimately cannot stand. He says, Sparta and Rome perished, as Rousseau said. What state can hope to endure forever?
Yeah, you know, I, with all due respect, I think there's kind of a genetic fallacy there, Professor Huntington. That is to say, sure, these ideas arose in an Anglo-Protestant context. But by gosh, this country is far more variegated than Anglo-Protestantism. And there's
Can I just interrupt right there? Because I think you're leading into a very unfortunate misinterpretation of what I'm saying. I draw a very strict distinction between ethnicity and culture. And when I talk about Anglo-Protestantism, I'm talking about culture, a set of attitudes, values, customs, and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. Anybody can adhere to that that culture. And as I said, immigrants who come to this country were largely attracted to it. It is not something which is the special preserve of those who happen to be Anglo-Protestant in terms of ethnicity. I have, when I discuss this with Jewish friends of mine and describe what I think of as our Anglo-Protestant culture, a frequent reaction is, oh, yes, of course, I am an Anglo-Protestant Jew.
But all I meant is that, yes, I understand what you're saying. These are sort of the habits of the heart in America. If you really trace them back, they are Anglo-Protestant.
That's their origin.
Their origin. Okay. But as somebody from a different tradition, what I'm struck with is what you're saying now about this immigration could well have been said about my forefathers, the Irish who came over here.
It was.
They're going to be they're unassimilated.
Oh,
their
absolutely.
Their ways are just foreign to us. They have their own school systems. They have their, my gosh, this benighted religion. They have no feeling for the Boston Athenaeum. They're not really all that fond of the Boston Library. What are we going to do with the Irish?
And there's the Irish and then the Italian in wave
and
after wave.
And on and on. And something called America assimilated.
Yeah,
we are going to have to stand back and look at all this. Samuel Huntington, Jack Beattie, we have to take a short break. Please stand by. We're talking about the fate and face of a changing nation, whether American identity can survive multiculturalism. Our guest is Samuel Huntington, author of the new book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity. Are you afraid of America losing its very identity under a tide of new immigrants, Hispanic and otherwise? Have multiculturalism and an embrace of diversity brought us to the brink of cultural self-destruction? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the fate and face of a changing nation, whether American identity can survive multiculturalism. Our guest is Samuel Huntington, Harvard professor and author of the new book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity. You can join the conversation. Is this 21st century alarmism echoing the 19th century fears of the Irish, the Chinese, the Italian? Can American identity survive without a conscious embrace of Anglo-Protestant culture? And is Sam Huntington too late? Are we already the multicultural nation Sam Huntington fears? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Samuel Huntington, how about it? Jack Beatty says, this sounds just like no Irish, Irish, please, and we survived that. We'll survive this.
That's right. What Jack says about attitudes towards the Irish is certainly true. But the problem is the situation the same today? This is the third great wave of immigration we have had. We had the mid-19th century wave with the Irish and the Germans, and then the second wave before World War I with immigrants coming from Eastern and Southern Europe. We now have a third wave with immigrants coming overwhelmingly from Latin America and from Asia. The question is, are the processes of immigration the same? In the past, we have had great diversity among immigrants. Now, for the first time, we have 50% or more of immigrants coming to this country speaking a single non-English language.
That would be Spanish, you're saying?
Absolutely, yeah. And that has never happened before. In the past, our immigrants have been very diverse. In the past, also, the immigration did not continue for a lengthy period of time. With respect to the Irish and Germans and others who came in the mid-19th century, our Civil War cut that off pretty much, plus the fact that the potato famine in Ireland disappeared. And now? And immigration was greatly reduced. World War I, and then the legislation Congress passed immediately after the war, drastically limiting immigration, cut off that second wave. Now we have a persistent wave. And as scholars of the process of assimilation point out, in the past, the fact that these waves of immigration were significantly reduced was an important factor in the successful assimilation of the immigrants into this country.
Open the doors, bring them in, then close the doors and assimilate them.
Exactly, exactly.
And now you're saying the new wave of immigrants, and you're not at all subtle about it. You're saying Mexicans at the heart of this keep on coming. They're contiguous to the former, to the country of their origin. They don't necessarily claim American citizenship at the same rate as other immigrants. Yeah. There's even the notion of reconquista, that is kind of settling what was Mexican before the United States.
Well, we took it from them by force in the mid-19th century.
So why be Americans when they're living there? They can say, sure.
So
that we understand, you've got a very alarmed book here with a lot of intellectual backup for it. But what's your nightmare scenario? What are you concerned may emerge from this unending wave?
I'm not making any predictions about what may emerge.
You're clear in saying we could go A, B, or C directions. How could this go?
Well, that's right. And it seems to me, and particularly with respect to the nature of current immigration and the increasing Hispanic presence in the U.S., 50% or more of which comes from Mexico. This is, it seems to me, and I present, I think, a lot of evidence to support this in the book, that we are moving in the direction of becoming a bilingual and bicultural society. Wherever you look, Spanish is assuming a significance comparable to that of English.
And what's the problem with this? If at the same time these Mexican Americans are embracing the values of American society?
Well, they may or may not be. The evidence on that is very mixed. And as many Mexican intellectual, scholarly, and political leaders have pointed out, and I quote some of them in my book, there's a vast difference between Mexican culture and values and American culture and values.
Are you saying Mexicans are incapable of becoming full Americans and embracing American
creed? No, I'm not saying that at all. And I think the ones who migrate here are more, have a certain proclivity to accepting our values, just like previous immigrants. But I'm saying that the context of in which they are coming, where you have the development of very substantial Spanish-speaking communities in the
Southwest, in Florida, for the Cubans, let's
and
say.
So forth. And also, the perhaps much more important is what you referred to initially, the changing character of American society. To the extent that multiculturalism plays a role in our society, we don't approach these immigrants the way in which your previous immigrants were approached. The previous immigrants were subjected to great pressures to Americanize and to adopt our values and culture and language. And in the pre-World War I period, all governments had active programs to Americanize the immigrants. Most states had bureaus or departments of Americanization.
And
corporations carried out similar activities. Now you don't have anything really like that. You have the argument being made and generally passively accepted that immigrants should retain their ancestral cultural language, heritage, and so forth and so on. It's, I think, of central importance here is this change in American society.
There's so much we want to get into this conversation. You're raising so many issues in such a stream. I'm sure it must be blowing many people's hair back. I've got to say that there's a mixture here of evidence and what feels to me like fear. And I wonder if we need to be that fearful. We'll come to it. But let me start to bring our callers in. We have so many waiting to join us. Marcello is calling from Neenah, Wisconsin. Hi, Marcello. Marcello, you're on the air.
Hi, I would like to first begin with saying that when you define America as a country, we should be defining America as a continent because I'm from Ecuador, South America.
And
I'm
from Ecuador, okay.
And I consider myself an American, although I'm not a United States citizen. So beginning with, I think that's the point where the people in the United States don't have an identity. They identify as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of self-pretentious thing.
It's pretentious to say we're Americans, all the entire continent or the hemisphere is American. Martell, let me ask you, are you an immigrant? Are you intending to become an American citizen or a long-term resident?
yes, I actually I'm in the process of filling up all those papers to submit my application to become a United States citizen.
And do you intend to make the American creed of liberty and equality and individualism your own?
I think I have all those creeds in my country too. It is not like only this country you can have liberty and all that stuff. Other countries, they probably have not the same economical power that the United States have right now, but we do have those liberties in there too.
And are you prepared to surrender your Ecuadorian identity to become an American? Are you prepared to embrace Anglo-Protestant culture as part of that, Marcello?
Well, I'm going to become a citizen of the United States just because I have a dual citizenship. I will not be losing my citizenship of Ecuador. I will be a citizen of Ecuador, and also I will be a citizen of the United States. If I do have to surrender my Ecuadorian citizenship, I will probably have to think twice about doing this thing.
Marcello, we've got it. Or Marcello, and let me put it to Samuel Huntington. I have to say, we understand your story, and I'm sure in many respects it's a common one. It also sounds, Samuel Huntington, something like your worst nightmare.
Well, you keep using that word nightmare. Now, come on, I don't talk about nightmare.
The end of Sparta, the end of Rome, the disintegration of a culture.
Well, wait a second. What I said was quoting Rousseau, is that he said that all societies come to an end, including Sparta and Rome. I also say very explicitly in my book, while that is generally true, the United States is a country which has the capability, as demonstrated in the past, to renew itself and revitalize itself and to deal with its problems. And I think that is one of the great characteristics of this country. And it stems from the fact that we do have a highly pluralistic society, an open society, as a result of the principles of the creed to which you referred.
But that's only one avenue that you describe. Others, including massive white backlash,
and also a kind
of disintegration.
Yeah, but wait a second. I say it is conceivable that there could be a white nativist backlash at some point in the future, and that would be most unfortunate. But I think, as I point out at some length in the book, that for 300 years, Americans were defined defined themselves in terms of race. Americans were people who were white, and we enslaved and then discriminated against and segregated blacks. We massacred the Indians. We excluded the Asians. And Americans were white up until well into the 20th century.
So?
And, well, what I'm saying is that there is this heritage. It happened before, and we should be aware of the possibility that there could be a white backlash of some sort. And you can see some inklings of that beginning in a very modest sort of way in the opposition to immigrants, expressed in several different initiatives, popular initiatives in California, where obviously there was a huge immigrant population.
But I'm simply saying that Marcello, with his dual citizenship, his unwillingness to concede American culture or identity as singular, where America is all of this hemisphere.
Wait a second. When he uses the word America in terms of this hemisphere, he's talking about a piece of territory, the Western Hemisphere.
Yes, but that's how he looks at it.
Okay, but that's not American society. We're talking about a society, not territory.
So isn't this the kind of immigrant mentality that you're concerned about?
Well,
a dual citizen.
Yeah, well, that brings up a whole range of other issues. We have increasingly something which we didn't have before, which was immigrants who are maintaining dual nationality and dual citizenship. In the past, immigrants generally fell into one of two categories. They were what I would call converts, and as many historians have pointed out, many of them had converted to America before they even got on the boat to come here.
Mm-hmm.
Others were sojourners who came here, worked for 15 or 20 years, and then went back to Sicily or Poland or wherever and lived very comfortably. We now have people who are dual nationals, transnationals, and as a result of the improvements in communication and transportation, the fact that they mostly come from Mexico or the Caribbean or Central America or Latin America, are able to maintain very close contacts with their ancestral countries.
And do, and they can keep that up. Samuel Huntington, if you'll permit me, I want to welcome you to our conversation from San Antonio, Texas. Andy Hernandez, he's director of the 21st Century Leadership Center at St. Mary's University. Good evening and welcome, Andy Hernandez.
Thank you. Good to be with you all.
Thanks for joining us. Andy, I understand you are fourth generation Mexican-American on your father's side, second on your mother's side. You've read some of Samuel Huntington's work around this issue of national identity. As a Mexican-American of long duration, long standing, what do you make of the argument? Is Mexican immigration a threat to the American identity?
Well, I don't think it is. And I think that Professor Huntington puts some research to bolster his argument in his write-in. But look, there's a lot of other research that's been done by scholars and by Poland organizations with a lot of credibility. For example, in 1999, Harvard University, along with Kaiser Family Foundation, did a survey among Hispanics, a national survey, and they asked Hispanics two questions. Is it important for Latinos to blend into mainstream America? 84% of those Latinos said it's important for Latinos to blend into mainstream America.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked another question, is it important for Latinos to maintain their cultures? 89% said it was. So you have this dual aspiration, this bicultural aspiration that doesn't deny or negate one or the other. Now, let me get to the American Dream question, which Professor Hunt has spent a lot of time talking about.
Well, the
American Dream, American Creed.
Yes.
Both.
Well, they're different, right?
Yeah,
one is about material accumulation in some respect and freedom. The other is about a commitment to liberty, equality, individualism, and so on. But anyway, Andy, let's hear it.
I think in the popular mind, it's one and the same. If we talk about what people believe America is about, those values, those principles, and what they believe that they can draw from their experience in America and their life in America, in the popular mind, among the great mass of folks, it's one and the same. I guess we could make intellectual distinctions. But let's talk about that. When you ask Latinos, do you believe in the American dream? 85% of them say they do. Do you believe you can attain it? Over 70% say they believe they can attain it, and over 90% say they believe their children can attain it. This is national surveys. So when you actually talk to Latinos through surveys, focus groups, or you actually talk to them on the streets, you don't get the picture that's being painted by Professor Huntington.
Let me get Sammy Huntington's reply here.
Let me just finish this.
Yep.
I'm just trying to answer some of the things he's already said.
Yes.
When you ask Latinos, is it important for Latinos to know English well and to perform well and be proficient in English? They say, 90% plus say yes. When you ask Latinos, is it important for their kids to go to college? They more likely say it's more important to go to college to get ahead than our Anglo parents. So on all those questions, when you talk about work ethic, there was some initial studies done on work ethic, looking at Anglos and Mexican workers done in the 80s. I don't know if Professor Huntington is familiar with those studies, but all those studies showed that actually Mexican workers have a stronger work ethic than Anglos do, those immigrant workers in the United States. And if we're going to use anecdotal evidence, something that he uses quite a bit of, and uses one or two people of Mexican origin to bolster his case, their perspectives, if we're going to use anecdotal evidence, how many people out there listening today know immigrant workers and believe that these workers are not hard workers or don't have a hard work ethic? They're doing the hardest job in the most unsafe conditions for the longest hours and the smallest amount of pay. If that isn't a work ethic, I don't know what is.
Andy Hernandez, we're going to have to come back with Samuel Huntington after a break to get his response here, but we've got your bill of particulars, and we thank you for being with us tonight. Andy Hernandez, director of the 21st Century Leadership Center at St. Mary's University in San Antonio, Texas. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about the fate and face of a changing nation, whether American identity can survive multiculturalism, with Samuel Huntington, author of the new book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity. How does Samuel Huntington's identity call to arms sound to you? Desperately needed? Racist? A hard truth? An old fear? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Harvard professor Samuel Huntington, author of the new book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity. You can join the conversation. Can America's new rainbow of races and cultures carry forward the American identity, the American creed? Is this the argument of the American future, the American past? Is this the eternal American argument? We're 1-800-423-8255. Samuel Huntington, we heard from Andy Hernandez saying, look, Latinos, sign on to the whole smorgasbord of what it means to be an American. What's your complaint, Professor Huntington?
Well, yes, they talk it. And I think as Mr. Hernandez's remarks, one has to draw a distinction, however, as you pointed out, between the creed, which is a collective belief about the nature of our society and what it should be and the principles underlying the society, And the American dream, which I interpret it as a very individual thing, that it was well expressed by President Clinton at one point, whom I quoted in my book, as saying that that means that if you work hard and have the abilities, you ought to have the opportunity to go as far as you possibly can in life.
And I think, that is not enough, you're saying.
Well, that's I think that's terribly important. That is part of this Anglo-Protestant culture I've been talking about, and to the extent that Hispanics subscribe to that, that's tremendous, and most immigrants have. But let me get on to the two other points that he raised. One concerned education, and he quoted polls indicating that Hispanic parents all wanted their children to go to college and
right.
so forth and so on. But why don't they go to college? 35 to 40% of Mexican-American, at least, drop out of high school with no high school degree, according to the study done by Rodolfo De La Garza and his associates. In 1990, only less than 10% of Mexican-Americans in the fourth generation. We're not talking about recent immigrants. We're talking about fourth generation Mexican-Americans. Less than 10% had a post-high school degree.
So is that a failure of American-ness?
As compared with 45% of other Americans.
So,
and less than 4% of Mexican Americans in the fourth generation, less than 4% had a college degree as compared with 20% of other Americans.
So is that a failure, in your view, to identify with the core American identity? Or is it, a failure on America's part to put up the schools and reach out to these new Americans to bring them in?
They drop out of the schools. And if you look at the descriptions of Mexican culture, it does not value education and in the same way in which we do. And as a result, needless to say, if you have this high percentage of high school dropouts, which is more than twice that of it's 2 to 3 times that of blacks, and is 4 or 5 times that of non-Hispanic whites in this country, obviously they are not going to get very far in terms of making achieving success in our economy.
Jack Beatty, I feel on a tightrope here above a sea of evidence and racial profiling. I don't know what to make of it, except to say that, you know, I thought where we were heading was toward an embrace. Sam Huntington's raising all kinds of flags here saying maybe this isn't working, but an embrace of multiculturalism, and that the sweep of this country's ideals and political principles and affluence would all together wash us forward under one umbrella. Can we not have faith in that?
Well, that has been the American faith. A sociologist once said that America is the euthanasia of memories. It's taking a long time. But you know what? I think the Irish, if you look at this, Professor, the fourth generation is pretty much where we are, maybe fifth for some. And it's only been in my lifetime, really, that the Irish have quite got with the program. For example, they were notoriously, a civil service culture and so on.
That's right.
Now, low on entrepreneurship,
yep.
Low on these other things. So this has taken a long time for this immigration to really get with the whole American program. And I'm not saying this isn't a different thing, but, you know, the factors were similar there. Peasant culture. Prohibitions yep. against learning, not necessarily within the Irish, but from the English on the Irish. Mm. And in Latin America, it's from the bosses, you know, the people who run the society.
The hacienderos.
Know, yeah. So an agricultural people. And we've had similar issues with assimilation with our African-American population who came from slavery, who came from agriculture, who went to the city, and we're having a slow process thankfully, it's beginning to change. And discrimination has played a part in all of these stories, slowing this process of assimilation. I rather like the parable of assimilation in the movie Spellbound. Did you happen to see it?
No.
It's about the National Spelling Bee contest. Yeah. And one of the winners in it was a 12-year-old girl who was spelling words like autochthonous and prestidigitation. Her dad had a third-grade education, worked on a ranch in Texas, can't speak English to this day, but he sat there in that audience listening to her spell what could have been gibberish to him with a smile a mile wide, and everybody who watched that thought, that's a parable of assimilation.
We have faith in that?
Well, you can have faith in it, but that doesn't mean that it's fact. People have lots of faith in things that are not fact.
But isn't the alternative a kind of setting up an impossible cultural purity?
No. Come on, Tom. Let me get back to what Jack made. He always takes us back to the Irish, which is...
It's Jack Beatty.
Yeah, it's neat. It took the Irish several generations. That was the pattern then. The first generation didn't speak English. The second generation spoke both languages. Of course, the Irish did speak English, the third generation, however, became fully acculturated with this vast documentation by sociologists and historians of the three-generation process of assimilation. Now, that may take place with respect to Mexican Americans or other Hispanics. We'll see in the future, but all I'm saying is that conditions were very different there. They were precious to assimilate in the way in which which don't exist now. And assimilation and Americanization is in many circles, including those I move in, is a bad word. It's a nasty word. If you talk about Americanizing immigrants. And as I indicated, at least in this one study, fourth generation Mexican Americans still deviate highly from the model American.
Sam Huntington, with that, we are out of time, and I'm sorry for it. There's a lot more to talk about here. You have raised issues that are sure to be fiery and debated for years in the book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Tom. I enjoyed being here.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, part two of our D-Day series on stories from the men who fought in Normandy. This is On Point. To commemorate the 60th anniversary of D-Day, On Point is bringing you a special four-part series of stories from the men who battled on the beaches of Normandy. Last night, we heard D-Day veterans recall the anxious and arduous process of preparing for the invasion. Tonight, the attack from the skies. Shortly after midnight on June 6, 1944, American and British airborne forces launched 2,219 warplanes, gliders, and C-47 Dakota aircraft into the skies over the English Channel. The warplanes bombarded Normandy beaches. The C-47s carried 13,000 paratroopers behind enemy lines in France. Their mission was to secure bridges and roads that the German army might have used to reinforce troops on the coast. The voices of the airmen, pilots, and paratroopers you will now hear are part of Voices of Valor, a new book and CD collection by Douglas Brinkley and Ronald J. Drez. Now, part two of our special D-Day series, The Airborne Invasion.
As we took off and circled into our rows of V's, I saw for the first time a C-47 aircraft painted solid white out in front of us. It was the mothership that was to lead us in.
Between midnight and now, some 20,000 glider troops and paratroops have landed in France.
13,400 paratroopers in all, in an armada 300 miles long, 9 planes wide, flying in 3 Vs and at altitudes from 7,000 to 500 feet.
We flew parallel to the Cherbourg Peninsula, and as we neared the beachhead, we saw the most memorable sight of the war.
You could see people, tanks, and trucks running every which way on the ground.
And I just thought about that. Man, I'm up here looking at this stuff down top here, and they're out there waiting to get up on that beach.
All I can remember, there was a general terrific thump. There was a shower of lead flying about the place, and there was splintering and that sort of noise, grating, splintering. It's like a crash.
I laid on that road for an hour, solid hour, and all I was saying was, hello, four dog, ham and jam, ham and bloody jam, what the hell don't you answer?
The C-47 began to bounce up and down as the pilot fought to avoid the increasing anti-aircraft fire.
Then the red light goes out and the green snaps on. We shuffle out the door in the dark, fresh air. I'm amazed at how quiet it is outside.
The next command echoed inside the plane. Hook up. Each of us removed the static line from the chute pack and attached it to the cable running down the center of the plane, just above our heads.
We were to jump at 600 feet, but it seems to be much higher than that. I hear the sound as the ship fades away. I hear gunfire, but it all sounds far away.
My legs felt as if they would go out from under me. Over the roar of the engines and the flak came Cole's next order.
All is quiet to the south, but to the north I see tracers arcing across the sky. And in spite of all that's going on, I think of how beautiful they appear.
Check equipment. I checked the man in front of me to see if he was hooked up properly. The darkness of the plane made it difficult to do much more.
I look around as though I'm just hanging up there all by myself. Just one big target for someone to shoot.
I got out of my chute. I assembled my rifle, and about the time I got it assembled, I saw somebody coming up the hedgerow.
We were told if we landed outside this area, we would be at very high risk of being captured or worse.
I crouched down in the weeds. These people got almost to me. They looked like Americans. The silhouette of the helmet looked like they were Yanks.
A C-47 flew over, and a stick of 16 or 17 troopers jumped out, but no chutes opened as the men were dropped too low. I could hear the bodies as they hit the earth, like watermelons falling off the back of a truck. Plop, plop, plop.
Many of the troopers were killed before they hit the ground or shortly after they landed. Some were still hanging in trees. They look like rag dolls, shot full of holes.
We entered the edge of a large square with a church at our left side.
We passed the church where a trooper had landed directly on its steeple. His chute was still swaying slowly in the breeze with no one in it.
There were troopers lying everywhere, almost all of them still in their chutes.
The company that had jumped here had landed in the middle of a German headquarters unit.
I determined that I would not go down the road to see if I could do anything for them, as I knew that they were all killed. I cussed the pilot and the crew of the 47, the Germans, the war, everybody.
I can't see my stick, but I know they're out there somewhere drifting down in the dark. I look down, it seems quiet. I can just make out rows of trees. I think to myself, this is France, and now I'm in combat. This is for real.
John Howard, Edward Tappenden, Carl Cartledge, John Fitzgerald, Dwayne Burns, Leland Baker, Sherman Euler, James Eads, Roger Lovelace, Alfred Corey, and J.K. Havener, just a few of the more than 20,000 American, British, and British airmen, pilots, and paratroopers that launched the airborne invasion of Normandy 60 years ago this Sunday. Tomorrow night, part three of our special D-Day series, The Attack from the Sea. Special thanks for the audio of these oral histories to Douglas Brinkley and Ronald J. Drez of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies at the University of New Orleans. Their new book and CD set is called Voices of Valor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.